Major Aikman, Reel 9. Now, the next thing you're going to touch on is, as part of the German efforts to disrupt the preparation for D-Day, was the air raid on Plymouth. I wonder if you could comment on, tell us a bit about that.
Before the invasion of Europe, the German air raids increased, and there were several very spectacular air raids on Plymouth itself. The coast artillery, in the run-up to the this stage of the war, had been supplied with anti-aircraft guns, and I had had to see to the training of the various batteries with 40mm Bofors light anti-aircraft as secondary armament. And there were several batteries in the Plymouth area that had been so equipped. There was a very spectacular air raid with a lot of noise, and I was in the headquarters of the Coast Artillery at Wembury in the requisitioned hotel, and I can remember Brigadier Weigel inquiring of me whether the batteries would have known that they were authorised to engage any targets with their secondary light anti-aircraft equipment, and I assured him that there would be no way that you could have stopped them from using them if there had been any targets. That was just part of the run-up, and then we saw the ships being loaded and prepared for the invasion, and the Coast Artillery had less to do once the invasion, had nothing to do once the invasion had started.
You actually saw, did you realise they were actually going?
Oh, of course we knew they were going. We had known that these areas that were being closed off, with the soldiers within the areas being briefed as to their exact and detailed tasks, we knew that you could not move freely anymore. Everyone, civilians included, would be well aware that a major operation was in the train. And there were the preparations for the loading of vehicles onto invasion craft, and there were a lot of small American-type vessels in places like St. Ives and Penzance.
Now, another thing you wanted to comment on was the American attitude to officers-only establishments.
Yeah, I was amused at that. When the war started, and I was in Salisbury Plain before we had sailed to France, as soon as the war happened, you found that the more upmarket hotels in Salisbury suddenly put up notices saying officers only in script that showed that they'd had them in stock for the last 20 years. They didn't last more than a few days before they were taken down again. When the Americans arrived in force in Devon, you found that the Americans were putting up notices saying officers only in upmarket venues, which somewhat amused me. I can remember an RAF sergeant pilot who was in the habit of going to the dinner dances at the Imperial Hotel in Torquay, indignantly stating he was not going to pay any attention to these notices and did not do so.
What did you think of it personally?
I thought it was, I was amused that the Americans had this old-fashioned attitude that we Brits had got past.
Now, anything else with the Southern Command? It seems that the whole point of your the coastal artillery units in the southwest area seems to have gone once the invasion of mainland Europe had begun.
Indeed, the teaching, of course, of coast artillery is that you are a deterrent, and 98% of your time you're simply there to deter. At which I suppose we were. The action that one expected would be of the kind of the E-boat raid on Falmouth that I've reported. At the end of the war, when German surrender was imminent, there was the fear that some doctrinaire Nazi would take a warship in and use it to bombard some civilian targets, but that never happened.
So when was your next post? Did you stay in the southwest right to the
end? No, once my appointment, the appointment of instructor in gunnery is a time-limited thing, and I was transferred to a Scottish regiment, the 505 4th Regiment at the conclusion of my
505
brackets FORTH Regiment, and went to their regiment headquarters on the south bank of the Forth in Edinburgh. To
was that Queensferry or
no? It was in Edinburgh. I think Trinity is the name of the district of where it was. I could take you to it again. After a few days...
When did you go there? When would you say?
It would be spring 1944.
And that's before D-Day.
Oh, did it? I'm sorry. In that case, it's after D-Day. When was D-Day? May?
June.
It would be autumn. I was there in time for New Year's Day, so it would be autumn.
Round about Octoberish.
Yeah, Octoberish.
And what was the setup there? What was your role there?
I was simply sent there as a regimental officer. And the regiments, I mentioned that the Coast Artillery was very much being reduced. There were code words to mark the reduction in units. There was ebb tide was the first one, and flood tide wiped out most of the Coast Artillery. And so by the time I was there, the units had been very, very much reduced.
And so what was the dispositions of the unit round the... I presume it was round the Forth.
That's right, yes. The anti-motor torpedo boat defences were now on Inchcombe Island, or had been on Inchcombe Island. By the time I was there, they had been reduced simply to searchlights to illuminate. And on Inchkeith, there was still the 6-inch... close defence guns. The counter bombardment 9.2 inch were no longer in action. There was still a 6-inch battery at Leith and another one at Kinghorn, and there was the counter bombardment battery was a 6-inch Mark 24 on a Mark 5 mounting, like the ones that had been installed in Hartlepool, a similar battery at Kincraig, which was above the town of Ely in Fife, but most of the coast defences of the Forth were now into care and maintenance.
Now, what was your particular responsibility? You were just a regimental officer?
I was sent as a regimental officer, and the first job I was given was to be the officer on the island of Inchcombe. I was the only...
Which island is that? Is that the one immediately by the bridge?
The bridge itself is built on Inchmickery, and the next one down the river is Inchcombe, which is where the abbey is and where the, for many years, the kings of Scotland were buried. It's an island nearer to Fife than Edinburgh. You see it clearly from Edinburgh. It's a tourist thing. I went back not long ago, well, some years now, on a tour organised by the Heritage Scotland in conjunction with the Tall Ships Race. And I met some of the senior officials of Heritage Scotland who were glad to be told the way things had been on Inchcombe in the past.
Now, tell me how they were. What was the layout of the battery?
Well, in Inchcombe, the guns were all in care and maintenance, and therefore the equipment was simply searchlights and the engine room that went with it. I had about... 15 or 20 soldiers, and there was myself. It was a very bitter winter in the January of 45, and we relied on water, on a water boat that every 10 days would bring water to the island, and you would connect the pipes from the ship to our reservoir, and it would be pumped into storage. There were a couple of Royal Engineers on the island who were responsible for looking after that sort of thing, and I can remember some vigorous swearing between the Scots on the waterboat and the sapper NCO, because so deeply had the frost affected, there was no way they could pump their fresh water into our reservoir, and we had to wait for the weather to ameliorate.
What about other supplies?
Well, everything. There was a boat which came, I think, twice a day, a War Department boat. It was a civilian War Department boat, and at the slightest touch of bad weather, you would find that the boat would not run. And indeed, several times I found that I was abandoned in Leith with the evening boat not able to take me back to Inchcombe, and therefore I got to know the various officers, what did you call them, clubs, in Princes Street, for instance, where they would put you up for the night. And also I got to know a number of the hotels in Edinburgh where you would get a cheap bed and breakfast if you found yourself benighted, or indeed if you wanted to spend a night ashore. And of course, since I was the only officer on the island, I needed to get out from time to time to see what was going on.
Was anything much happening? I mean, it must have been quite boring.
It was fairly boring. When that bitter frost was on, one of the NCOs on the island was keen that he should use a blow lamp to thaw the pipes that came from a header tank on the top of a tower. But I had realised that the frost was hard enough to have frozen the water in the pipes on the island, which are not sunk at a very deep level, and reckoned it would be a waste of time. But they had spare time, and so they decided that they would do this. And I looked at the charts to see what they were doing and realised that the only place that particular pipe served was the officers' mess, of which I was the only occupant, so I let them carry on. But I was, of course, quite right. The water pipes were frozen in the ground. No, there was not much going on. It was simply a matter of being there and going through the routine. I was not there all that long. I was transferred to Inchkeith, which is the big island. The big island is the one which had on it. 392 guns, which were no longer in action, the 6-inch battery, and also it had the command post where the naval officers and the army officers were on duty. There were two naval and one army. The naval officers were responsible for maintaining contact with the inshore boats and patrols, if there were any, and also, more importantly, the various detecting devices that detected the presence of submarines and the like. I went there as one of the fire control officers. Normally in a coast artillery situation you will find that there is a major, a captain and another, and the three of them would take turns to provide 24-hour manning, responsible for the operational control of all the defences under command of the fire command. And so I took my turn. There were three of us on duty in the tower at one time, two naval and one army. There was not really very much to do, and so one of us kept a watch and answered the telephones or whatever, and the other two of us played chess. And I was intrigued to find that next time you found yourself on duty with the same naval officer, you could set up the chessboard without any problem as to where it had been when you left off. And there would be a certain interval because the army staffing was less generous than the navy, and the navy staffing came around fairly frequently. So it would be a while before you found yourself on duty with the same chess player.
You said tower. Which tower is this?
On Inchkeith. It's a concrete. There were a number of concrete structures that had been to control the fire of the coast artillery on the island, but this one was the one which was for the fire command, which, as I say, was a joint army-navy installation. And as the war came to an end,
Were you there right? Is that where you were until the war ended? If you
yes. When the war ended, the fire control side of the defences of the Forth were closed down, and at that stage I was posted to Orkney, where I could relieve.
Now, do you remember VE Day? Do you remember any particular VE Day celebrations on Inchkeith?
There was a lot of celebration. I was. On VE Day, I was, in fact, in the naval base at Port Edgar. Port Edgar is inland from, is further up the river than Queensferry. I went there because one of my cousins was the first lieutenant of HMS Witch, which was a, had been a destroyer and was being used for trials for some experimental equipment the Navy was interested in. And the HMS Witch used to sail past Inchkeith on its way to carry out its trials and on its way back every day. So occasionally we exchanged greetings from the signal tower as the destroyer went by. So I was there, and I celebrated with the Navy.
What was it like? What sort of...
I think everyone was very very relaxed and relieved. My cousin's wife was staying in a hotel in South Queensferry, the Mackenzie's Hotel, so-called, because it was owned by Mackenzie. You won't find it there anymore, or not under that name. And I can remember that he, Mackenzie, and my cousin's wife and I celebrated by opening three bottles of lager that he'd had in store, Danish lager that he'd had in store for that purpose. It was a very happy and very relaxed and very thankful occasion. The one thing which did occur just before VE Day, it was on the point of happening, and in the fourth, there is an island, the Isle of May, which is well out and barely in sight from Inchkeith, where early warning defences, it was manned by the RAF, and it was really for to deal with aeroplanes, but also, of course, was there to tell us about incoming shipping. And there was the RAF were excited at the fact that there was a destroyer coming in at full speed, and there had been this theory that some mad German might take the opportunity of the end of the war to shell civilians, and so the RAF were very excited at this destroyer coming in, and was anxious that I should fire a warning shot and bring it to a standstill. But I told him, or told the NCO, that I was not going to. It turned out that it was a ship of the which I think might have been the Norwegian. I think it was the King of Norway. Had some royal of one of the Scandinavian countries was coming in at high speed to celebrate the onset of peace. So it's as well that I disregarded the advice from the Isle of May and did not fire the warning shot to bring the ship to its...
So, now, how soon after VE Day was your posting to the Orkneys?
Days. We had known that the war was ending. All the preparations for the release scheme, where you were given priority in numbers dependent upon your age and the length of service. I was in grade 26, because although I had served from the beginning of the war, I was quite young, and so older men with less service were going to be released before I. And indeed, I was released well before Group 26, because I got special release to go back to Oxford, but that did not happen until...
Next year. Now, what happened? You went to 533 brackets Orkney Regiment.
That's right. 533 brackets Orkney Regiment.
And where were they based? I mean,
they were based on the island of Flotter. If you look at the Orkney, there are a number of islands. During the war, a lot had been done to join islands together so as to reduce the possibility of submarines passing between the two. But Flotter is fairly well in the middle of the Sound, or the south side, and that was where the headquarters was, and that's where I went. I spent time at Flotter, and also...
What were you doing at Flotter?
Simply being a regimental officer. And my temporary appointment of captain lapsed when I was transferred to Orkney, so I was now a lieutenant doing subaltern's work in a number of batteries in that Orkney regiment, until I was appointed to the headquarters of...
Now, can you tell anything about those duties, or was it really too routine to remember?
Well, fairly routine. They were... the Flotter regimental headquarters was fairly vague now. I can remember something of the people, but not a great deal. I was moved fairly rapidly from battery to battery. I think one of the memories...
Do you remember the location of the batteries?
Yes. One was on... No, I don't remember too well. I probably could refresh my memory with a map. I can remember being irritated at the sight of a lighthouse in bright sunshine at 12:30, which one could see from one of the batteries. But when we were on double British summertime, of course, and well north.
So not much to remember about your routine duties, and then you were posted as a staff captain.
Then I was moved.
Still a lieutenant, I presume. But
I was moved to Hawtney and Shetland Defences, and I did a number of roles there.
What was the Orkney?
The Orkney and Shetland OSDEF was a headquarters commanded by a brigadier. He was responsible for the defences in Orkney and in Shetland. He had a staff of the conventional structure, and when I first went there, I was relieved the camp commandant, and so I was responsible for the workings of the headquarters. My main task at that time, when VE Day happened in Orkney, the ship that served the Northern Lights and took the people around the various lighthouses and also kept the sea marks in place was in harbour at Stromness, and there was a big display of pyrotechnics from that ship. And not to be outdone, the sergeant's mess set light to a barrel of tar, and the local authority took the view that somebody should pay for the barrel of tar that had been burnt. And I can remember making sure, as far as I could, that it was not my sergeant's mess that was charged with it. I worked...
So this was still... Because this was about 5 months later. I mean, it's still rumbling on, was it?
Certainly. I was not long as camp commandant. I then became staff captain Q, where I was very much into this sort of thing. There was a lot of complication because there was a... the Ministry of Fuel had a store of coal... which should have contained some thousands of tons of coal, but manifestly contained none. And there was a great deal of to-do as to how this was to be accounted for, and I can remember the eventually getting arranging for this to be written off. I was working with the War Department land agent, who was a Scotsman who claimed to have once crossed the English border and gone as far as Gretna. There was a solicitor from Shetland, Hunter by name, who dealt with the money side of claims. Administratively, I found it quite difficult to de-requisition land that the army had occupied if no one had requisitioned it in the first time. The payment of compensation is quite complicated if you de-requisition something that the army is sitting in that nobody requisitioned in the beginning. We had a lot of defences, wire and the like to take down, and we used the Italian prisoners of war for this. The Italian prisoners of war had been in Orkney, and they had been building the barrages which blocked the gaps between the various islands, they started at the end of the war, before they returned to Italy. They started to take down some of the wire. It was intended by the War Department that the work should be continued by soldiers from the Polish Army. Clearly, it was impossible for the Polish Army to occupy camps that had been used by Italian prisoners of war, and so we had to devise, or they devised, a system whereby independent Scottish companies were created and occupied these camps for a period of weeks, which could then be handed over in all conscience to the Polish Army, which happened after I had left. One of the things that I saw as a routine was the manifest of the passengers that were coming on the boat from the mainland, and I can remember being surprised on one occasion to find that there was an officer of the US Army listed. and I made inquiries as to where he went, but he stayed on the ship. He had simply taken the ride in the boat so that he could report that I have been to Orkney, but he never actually left the ferry boat. Another of the minor amusements at that time, the headquarters had a very glamorous American staff car, and we had the most glamorous of our ATS staff to drive it. This was because the starter motor had failed, and the staff officer who used the staff car found himself having to swing the heavy engine, which was why the glamorous staff girl drove it. The brigadier's wife was an Australian, and she took exception to the sea crossing, which could be very rough. And I can remember I used to talk as the staff captain Q to the various civilian airlines that operated out of Orkney, as well as to the naval and RAF people who flew from Orkney, and she wanted to go to the mainland, and I sweet-talked the girl who looked after one of the civilian lines to book her a passage so that she would be carried by air to Edinburgh. But in the event, shortly before this was due to happen, there was a day on which the sea was like glass, and so she leapt on the ferry boat and crossed, so I had to cancel her crossing, I recall. The aeroplane service was the staff officers in Edinburgh did not understand the difficulties of Orkney. In Orkney, there is the principle that if it is fine, you do it, and if it's not, you don't. Most of the time, there is a strong wind blowing. It's very seldom that you find that the air is still, and you would find staff officers from Scottish Command Headquarters in Edinburgh would take the view that something should have happened on such a day, whereas you would not do that if the weather was inclement. And certainly we can remember happily senior staff officers flying up to Orkney not being deterred by the weather condition and taking off intending to go to Shetland, and finding themselves eventually landed at some aerodrome very close to Edinburgh, and much further away than they expected to be. I can also remember staff officers, or I can remember before I was there, I was told of staff officers who had been stuck in the middle of the harbour with high winds and no visibility, and for hours stuck inside the middle of the harbour. Orkney was, I was glad to be there, and it was a pleasant headquarters, and I learnt quite a bit about the other arms of the service, because one had to deal with the various branches that looked after the specialities of the, and as well as the coast artillery units themselves.
Were you aware of the historical significance of Scapa Flow? Did you take an interest? And the
yes.
Wrecks and all that?
One knew, but there wasn't very much that one could do about it. Scarra Brae was the Iron Age campsite, and I went round a number of the historic archaeological ruins, and there was an Office of Works guide who took you round. He was an Orcadian who had, I went round with him once, and there were a certain number of words which I could not understand. I went a second time, and the same words I did not understand. The office that I inherited as the Star Captain Q, the senior clerk was an ATS girl who had been recruited in Orkney, and I rapidly found that if I did not understand what she said, and I said, "Excuse me, Sergeant, what was that you just told me?" She would repeat more rapidly and more flustered, so that there would be no hope at all the second time. So I had to rely on the Staff Captain A, who shared my office, telling me what she had said after she had gone out if I did not understand. She was, her B release date came before mine, and for the first time in her life, she sailed from Orkney, took a train to Edinburgh, where she was demobilised and then caught the train back and the boat back to Orkney. So being demobilised was a considerable experience.